Cats tuned to yesterday, delivering programs from radio's golden years. Welcome, I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Coming up in this hour, True History, we hear a profile of the year 1907, coming up on the That Was the Year program. Next, a unique moment in American radio history as we hear a special called I Am an American, an undoubtedly patriotic broadcast hosted by movie actor Edward Arnold, who would later go on to portray leaders of the nation's past on the Mr. President series, was joined by Ralph Morgan, announcer Don Wilson, an audience of thousands, and a nearly 750-person chorus to drum up support for the I Am an American movement, founded by composer Benjamin Edwards Neal. The short-lived group's mission was to bring together both liberal and conservative citizens to an understanding that while we all come from different places and backgrounds, we can unite as Americans, underscored by the group's feeling of devalued citizenship in a late 1930s America and the country's need for a strengthening of its people through this united movement. Some speculate that the group fell in line in the aftermath and demise of President Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal that had brought the country out of the Depression. It reformed many statutes and laws that were oppressive to everyone, from the corporate banker to the local farmer. With the country's involvement in the Second World War looming, founder Benjamin Neal proposed an I Am an American Day to further push the group's directive of a truly united country at a time when he and his group felt like they were living in a disjointed society. While we hear much about patriotic and sacrificial efforts on the home front after we entered the Second World War, this singular effort took place at the Hollywood Bowl on June 12, 1939, and proved to be a truly unique show heard just once on NBC.
Tonight, the National Broadcasting Company microphones are broadcasting from the famed Hollywood Bowl, where tonight finds the I Am an American panegyric in full swing. Among the thousands of men and women gathered here this evening to witness and take part in this great movement, the names of famous people of the Southland stand out predominantly. A 750-voice chorus will combine its efforts with that of the Hollywood Serenade Symphony Orchestra. Our guests during the broadcast will include Edward Arnold and Ralph Morgan of screen fame. Just to find out more about this great movement, it is my extreme pleasure to introduce Ralph Morgan and Edward Arnold.
Thank you, Don Wilson. I'd like to say that I'm happy in participating in honoring young Americans.
Those are my sentiments exactly, Ralph. When I think of the great advantages of this country and the happiness that we enjoy...
It's really a pleasure to be able to say, I am an American.
Exactly.
You know, we don't have to shove a rifle in the hands of our children, Ed, when they reach their teens. We're in favor of peace. We enjoy being the best of friends with our neighbors.
Yes, and from the bottom of our hearts, we should want to do everything we can to help prevent the specter of war.
A lot of questions are being asked these days, Ed. Those questions lead us to one big query. What do we do to achieve this?
Well, surely you must have an answer for that one.
I think I have. But there are other questions to be asked first. Do we American parents fully realize our responsibilities? Do we consider it our first duty to teach our children the obligations of being an American citizen?
I think, Ralph, that every American parent recognizes those obligations.
Perhaps so, but a reminder shouldn't do a bit of harm. Perhaps we're inclined to become a little self-satisfied.
Self-satisfied?
Yes, Ed. We have everything here in America that we could ask for. But we're becoming a trifle too complacent, too assured of ourselves. You and I, well, we're going to have to leave it in the hands of the young people to carry on, you know.
The new generation, the generation that shortly will be at the polls, ready to vote and ready to carry on the commerce of our country.
That's right. That's why we and hundreds like us are here in the Hollywood Bowl tonight to give tribute to the honored guests, the boys and girls who, on attaining their majority, are assuming the stature of full citizens.
And with the honor of becoming citizens, they are assuming a few new obligations too, Ralph.
Yes, I'm afraid they are, Ed. During that past year, they have begun to realize the import of being an adult, of finding the obligations that confront them and their companions.
Well, if you don't mind, Ralph, I'd like very much to pay my respects to these young people, and also to the founders of this movement.
And let's not forget the organizations in back of the movement that made it possible. I'd like to thank Benjamin Neal, who started out with this idea.
You know, I've been wondering, Ralph, just what the final picture will be.
I'm sure of just this much, Ed. As this I Am an American movement spreads across the country, I know that every American in every American community will extend the hand of friendship and encouragement, a helping hand to the new voting citizens as they make ready to join us in maintaining the American way of government by and for the people.
Thank you, Edward Arnold and Ralph Morgan, and may we hope that your sentiments will re-echo across the continent as this great movement goes ahead.
America, led by Hugo Kirchhoff. And please, everybody.
Beyond the sight of domed capitals, towering monuments, and the circumstances of a nation's greatness is a vast army of little men and women. They are the nation. They are the will to do and the substance of all real greatness. Within the walls of their small world is fought and settled the issues that face the leaders, and as they think, so must think the nation. They are America. There are millions of folks like the Parkers, mother and dad and two boys, Ralph and Tom. And all that happens in other families happens here.
Hey, Ralph, where's my blue tie?
What are you looking at me for? Am I wearing it?
You took it.
Have I got it on?
Where is it? I've got to wear it tonight.
Where are your green ones?
No, you took it. You keep away from my clothes. You've got plenty of neckties.
It won't hurt if I wear it once in a while.
You ask me if you want to wear my stuff.
Don't be so touchy.
Dinner's ready. Come on. Have you washed up, Ralph?
Hours ago.
Come on now. Where is my necktie?
I haven't got it.
Now, I'm not going to wait dinner. It's all on the table. Come on to the table without your necktie.
I've got to have it for tonight.
Where are you going?
You wouldn't understand. Let's go to dinner.
Who's the girlfriend?
No girlfriend.
Oh, is it a secret?
No, this is my birthday, isn't it? Maybe I'm going to celebrate.
Oh, so you're getting secretive on your 21st birthday. Tom, I can remember a couple of years ago when I was 21 and on the threshold of manhood. I felt very important and said to myself, Ralph Parker, from now on, whatever you do is your own business. Don't tell a soul.
Now, wait a minute. Sit down, you two. Sit down there and quit ragging each other. Your mother's worked too hard to argue you into eating.
Nobody's ragging anyone. I just asked Tom where he was going and he won't tell me.
Now you know how I feel when you won't tell me where you're going.
Oh, I'm not curious.
Oh, I'll bet you're not. Come on, eat your dinner. Oh, what are you? Where are you going, Tom?
To the Hollywood Bowl.
Where?
The Hollywood Bowl.
Oh, Mother's been reading something about that to me. It's I'm an American Day, isn't it?
It's what?
There, you see, Ralph's only going to make fun of it.
Well, what's it all about, Tom?
Well, it's for men of 21. It's to promote good citizenship.
Now, what's the matter with you? Aren't you a good citizen?
Yes, and I'm going to stay one.
Well, what do you do?
Oh, we take an oath. A sort of promise to be American.
You have to promise a thing like that?
Well, after some of the things I've heard you say, maybe it takes a promise.
Oh, so you're going to start that.
I don't think lots of the things you drag in here are signs of good citizenship.
Such as what?
Oh, all that talk about the dangers of this class and that class, and wanting to make certain people stand by while the rest of you put on tin uniforms and pretend to be saviors of mankind.
Maybe I know a few things you don't know.
Well, maybe you do, but that's not the way to settle them.
Wait till you've seen a few more things. You'll realize that this is a new world.
I don't see anything new about one kind of people making another kind of people miserable. That was done a couple of thousand years ago.
So you think good citizenship is standing by and just letting things go to pieces?
No, I don't. But whatever has to be done, I think should be done with honor.
So you're going down there with a lot of other babes in the woods and promise to be honorable.
There's nothing wrong in that.
Listen, There's lots wrong with this country, and making promises won't help.
Now, just a minute before this gets too hot. Well, let's hold a little court here. Sounds to me like more has been going on in this family than I had any idea. I can't make out just what you are, Ralph, but whatever it is, I gather Tom doesn't like it.
There's plenty of guys just like him, screaming their heads off about what's wrong and getting everyone mad.
Well, sometimes nobody will listen until you do scream. The system is all wrong.
What system?
Well, the American system.
Oh, is it? And why?
Because it is.
Do you honestly believe that, Ralph?
Yes, I do.
They ought to put you in jail for saying that.
Oh, wait a minute now. Now, that's one of the things that is right about our system here. A man can be honest to his convictions and stay out of jail.
Ralph is always talking about how bad things are, about the Depression and the Dust Bowl and the migratory workers, and how big money is running things their own way.
Now, before we go too far into getting mad at each other, let's go into this a bit. Mother, you be the judge.
Now, don't get me into this. I have enough to do to keep my own house in order.
No, that's where you're wrong. You've got to be a part of keeping the big house in order, too.
I haven't time, Father.
Now, listen. You women scream for the right to vote. And now that you've got it, you might as well get interested enough in what's happening to know where to mark your ballot. Tom, Ralph, I've always wondered just what I'd say when you came to me and asked me to tell you what being an American meant.
You don't have to tell me. Tell him.
No, I think you both need it. You know, it's very easy to tell you that every step of American history has been a glorious march in the progress of empire. Well, not every step has. We've got a lot to be forgiven for. And I'm doing my best to pay that debt by trying not to hurt anyone in my lifetime. All nations are a bit hard on the world when they're growing up, just like children are. When you get to be a man, you don't just grab a piece of candy away from a stranger just because you know he can beat him up, you can beat him up. Oh, you've got better sense.
Oh, sure, we know all that.
Oh, do you? Well, let's take a look around today. As man to man, we've had wars, we've had depressions. We've had troubles of all kinds. Troubles we had 100 years ago, we don't have anymore. The American people, in their patient way, straightened out those difficulties. You see, we Americans have a great weapon in our hands, and that weapon is our vote. Now, not everyone who votes is fully aware of the whole problem, but usually there is a basic rightness in the majority to make things come out right.
But there are lots of things that voting won't help.
That's true, Ralph. We're 135 million people, and that's a lot of people. And there is almost certain to be a number of that population who are not completely happy. One of the fine things about America is that there is a greater percentage of happy people here than in any place in the world. We have poverty, yes, but we'd have 20 times that poverty if your government hadn't done the things it has done to clear up so much of it. Now you hear people talk about high taxes. Why, they don't know what taxes are. Just ask them to name any country that has less than twice as much as we have. There isn't any. I know one country that makes the poorest wage earner pay over 40% of his income in taxes.
Oh, that's very well, Dad.
Now, Ralph, wait a minute. I don't like pretty phrases. Oh, I could think up a lot to say to make you go right out and shout, "Hooray, America!" But we're men. Tom's a man. And I think you can listen to what I think of America, not as your dad, but as a man who votes and works in America. You want to hear?
Sure. Go ahead, Dad. I'd like to hear.
Now, your mother and I have been through some strange times together. A couple of market crashes, a war, a long depression. We've watched little men rise and big men fall. We've seen men preaching against America on the curbstones and even in great halls. We've seen the shadows of other flags in the sky that held the waving stars and stripes. Some arguments we heard have been pretty convincing. And some, the shouting, well, has been pretty loud.
Dad, some of those men who shout want to do away with all we have and make it all different.
Yes, they use pretty strong language.
Well, what are we supposed to do?
That's what most of us Americans are thinking right now. We see how things are going in other parts of the world, and we say to ourselves, it mustn't be that way here.
Well, if things are wrong, we've got to make them right, don't we?
Americans are strange people, Ralph. A new kind of people who find that living in peace with his neighbor is a very comfortable way to live. He has a weapon that is a match for any kind that is used against him. It's called tolerance. That sounds like a pretty ineffective weapon, doesn't it? But it really isn't.
But we can't just sit back and let the other fellow get his way, can we?
But if you fight him with his own weapons, then you become like him. Dictators first make people hate another kind of people, and on that hatred, they rise to power. Over here, we don't get mad so easily. We've been watching the world. We've been seeing what intolerance can do, and we don't like what it has done.
Yes, but what about all those men we read about who want us to take up arms and fight certain classes?
Yes, yes, there have always been men who want to do that. History is full of them. But they never amount to anything unless they can get rid of tolerance and make a lot of people hate the way they hate.
What are we going to do?
This is still a democracy. Back of it all is a great population that reaches from coast to coast. That's us. We live and die, and listen and think and vote. We never put it into words, but we're the ones that count in spite of all the big gestures that important men make. We till the fields, we work at our business, we work in the factories. Sometimes those big fellows ignore us and think we don't count. And then we come along with the vote, and they wake up to realize they made a mistake about us. Oh, we criticize a lot and we express dissatisfaction about many things, but I don't think that's so very strange. I've always said that the beginning of things for a man or a country is dissatisfaction. If your ancestors weren't dissatisfied with George V and his ministers, we wouldn't be a nation today. But when we're really faced with the reality of things, every darn one of us says the same thing. I am an American. I belong to a nation that touches two oceans, and between those two lie forests and farms and cities, great cities and vast deserts. But beauty alone isn't enough, nor numbers of people. It's the heart of America that you must find. And where does that heart beat? In all of us who believe in the future, in all of us who have faith that people are basically good, that out of the goodness of our forefathers came the two greatest documents on the face of the earth, the United States Constitution and the Bill of Rights. I'm an American, and I believe that my country marches towards a future that shall ensure the best of the greatest number. That is democracy. And I believe that I'm a compatriot of the most humble citizen and a partner to the most important. In these times, it is easy to hate. And yet, where in all history has hatred solved a problem for humanity? No, I won't hate. Hatred is not a part of the American way.
Are we to be indifferent to things?
No, no, no. That is the greatest of all sins. You have a heritage, a debt not only to those who have gone before, but a debt to those who must come after. You must take this priceless heritage and preserve it, better it, honor it, and defend it. It is now your responsibility. Love the soil of America, but respect those who love other soils. Believe in what is right for America, but respect those who believe does not agree with yours. Be a part of the future, but don't forget that the future is only a maturing of the past. And when you are alone, say to yourself, I'm an American, and thank God in heaven that you are. What time do you have to be there, Tom?
Oh, gee, Dad, I've got to go right now.
Oh, Tom, here's a present for you. Happy birthday.
It's a new blue necktie.
You like it?
Gee, it's swell, Ralph. Thanks.
Tom, could I go along with you?
You mean to the bowl? You want to watch me take the oath?
Maybe I could take it with you.
Oh, and it's only for those who are 21.
Well, I'm 23. That ought to let me in, don't you think so, Dad?
Yes, I think so.
Okay, come on, Ralph. So long, you two.
Ralph.
Yes, Dad?
I'm awfully glad.
Good night, Dad.
Good night, son.
Now, I made that dessert especially for Tom. John?
Huh?
I didn't know you felt that way about being an American.
Well, you know, Mother, I never really thought it out before. You know, I'm sort of glad I said it. I've been so used to it that I never thought what a wonderful thing it is to be an American.
The story of the real American and his pride in his country is told in song by one of the stars from the Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer lot, Mr. Douglas MacPhail. The Masked Singers, directed by Robert Ziegler, sing Benjamin Neal's stirring tribute, I Am an American.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, Douglas McVeigh of the MGM lot has just been heard supported by the masked singing chorus in Benjamin Neal's stirring tribute, I Am an American. In the sketch which preceded it, unquestionably you are interested in the characters who portrayed Edward Arnold, Grace Hayes, Randolph Brooke, and Tom Neal. I know that every American will be interested in the man who was the founder and inspiration behind this great patriotic movement. And so let me ask Mr. Benjamin Neal to step forward. Mr. Neal.
Thank you, Don. To the young people of 21, I'd like to say that now an unnamed leader will lead in reading the creed, I Am an American. You people present in the Hollywood Bowl tonight are evidencing your determination to be good Americans by your presence. The people who are listening over the air can give us the same support merely by your determination. The unnamed leader has been selected by a competition judged by Lawrence Larrabee of the Board of Education, D.D. Durr of the Los Angeles Newspaper Publishers Association, and Don E. Gilman of the National Broadcasting Company. And the unnamed leader will now lead in reading the creed. One line at a time, will be read, and the honored guests will repeat after him the solemn words of this dedication to good citizenship. Ladies and gentlemen, the unnamed leader. Remember, he will read one line at a time, and then the honored guests will repeat that line after him. I am an American.
I am an American.
The golden rule is my rule.
The golden rule is my rule.
In humility and with gratitude, I acknowledge my undying debt to the founding fathers who left me a priceless heritage,
which now is my responsibility.
With steadfast loyalty, I will uphold the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. I will treasure my birthright of American ideals. I will place moral integrity above worldly possessions. Problems of interest to my country shall be of interest to me. I will count my right of suffrage to be a sacred trust. And I will diligently strive to prove worthy of that trust. I will give my full support to upright public servants. But those with unclean hands, I will firmly oppose. Each obligation that comes to me as a true American, I will discharge with honor. My heart is in America. And America is in my heart. I am an American.
The Star-Spangled Banner. Mr. Hugo Kirchhoffer, directing. The Hollywood Bowl has played host to thousands of young Americans and their elders, all taking part in the great panegyric, I Am an American. Included among all well-known guests this evening were, as we mentioned a few moments ago, Grace Hayes, Edward Arnold, Frank Morgan of the Film Colony, as well as Tom Neal and Randolph Brooks. Music has been played by the Hollywood Serenade Orchestra, directed by Elias Breeskin. The featured solo was sung by Douglas McVale of the Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Lot, and the chorus of 750 singers from the schools of the Los Angeles area have been directed by Mr. Robert Ziegler. Mr. Hugo Kirchhoffer has directed the community singing. The principal speaker was the founder of the I Am an American movement, Benjamin E. Neal. This is Don Wilson speaking and returning you now to our Hollywood studios.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.
I Am an American, a special on Tuned to Yesterday, the group that time nearly forgot, from June 12, 1939 on NBC. The I Am an American group and movement would fold after the Second World War, but now serves as an example of a group of people who were interested in uniting all of the citizens of the country before World War II more or less pushed many hands together to take on a united front at home against the threat of an Axis victory. You are listening to an hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark LeVonier. And now actor Gerald Moore in one of his earliest radio efforts from 1935 as host in the That Was the Year series. This next broadcast profiles 1907.
That was the year.
That was the year.
Recreating notable events of passing time. Reviving memories of men and women who have contributed to the history of a modern world.
That was the year. Some years previous, Scottish-Australian John Alexander Dowie founded the Christian Catholic Church, established Zion City, Illinois, set up schools, a university, a publishing house for religious works, general merchandise stores, and factories for the manufacture of soap, lace, candy, clothing, harness, and crackers. But no doctors, no drugstores. In 1903, John Alexander Dowie decided it was high time to invade New York City. Arriving in 8 trainloads, Dowie and 3,000 of the self-termed Zion's Restoration Host marched to Madison Square Garden. But sophisticated Manhattan refused to take the invaders seriously, calling them Satan Stormers. Seething under the ridicule, Dowie made haste to scold his critics with burning invectives. And at one Madison Square meeting...
This so-called city is nothing more than the whiskey part of creation. These dirty yellow dogs...
Dowie!
These rats, these maggots who
Mr.
dare...
Mr. Dowie!
Who is that? What do you mean by disturbing this peaceful Christian meeting?
Mr. Dowie, I challenge you to a debate. Right here and right now.
Debate? Who are you?
My name is Carrie Nation.
What?
And I've come here to challenge you to a debate.
Carrie Nation, wife, you... Soldiers of Zion, put that woman out of this place. Put her out, I say. Put her out.
Following the New York debacle, Dowie knew that he'd been definitely undermined in the thoughts of his followers. Broken mentally and physically after a stroke in 1905, he sailed for the West Indies, leaving a triumvirate in control of Zion City. After a month, he deposed them, set up Wilbur Glenn Voliva as dictator. Quickly realizing the error of diplomacy, Dowie attempted to depose Voliva. And upon Voliva's outright refusal, the Patriarch of Zion returned and feebly tried to stamp out the rebellion against him. But with the consent of his wife and son, John Alexander Dowie was himself deposed. And on March 9, 1907, in the religious empire he had founded, died alone, forgotten, a useless, tired, decrepit old man.
1907, That was a year
that District Judge Kennesaw Mountain Lander sprang to fame and later to fortune as high mogul of professional baseball by imposing the largest fine in the history of United States, $29,240,000, against the Standard Oil Company of Indiana, which decision was later reversed upon appeal.
Upon being informed of the fine, John D. Rockefeller is alleged to have remarked to newspaper reporters,
"Judge Landis will be dead a long while before this fine is paid."
1907. That was the year
that one of the most spectacular trials in the annals of crime came to a startling conclusion. On the evening of December 30, 1905, in an office in the small town of Caldwell, Idaho, Frank Sternenberg, ex-governor of Idaho, talks to his 25-year-old son.
"Well, son, I guess we better get on home. Mother will be waiting with dinner."
"All right, Dad."
"Come along."
"Think it's going to snow, Dad?"
Yes, looks as though it might before morning. That sky is pretty black."
"Hello, Mr. Sternenberg."
"Hello, Jack."
"Hello, Jack."
"You go along, Dad. I want to talk with Jack a minute."
"All right. Good night, Jack."
"Good night."
"Say, Jack, if it snows, let's get up
soon." "Ach, lieber Augustin, 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 Augustin. Guess I better oil the hinges on this gate tomorrow."
"Frank! Frank! Frank, where are you? Frank!
What's the matter, Mother? What does this mean?"
"Oh, Frank. Oh, I knew it would end like this."
In 20 minutes, Frank Sternenberg was dead. The next day, citizens of Caldwell and cattle ranchers from the surrounding territory gathered in little excited groups.
"Got any suspects yet, Sheriff?"
"Nope, not yet. That snowfall last night should have helped us to track down anybody that was trying to get away, too."
"Pardon me, gentlemen."
"Eh?"
"My name is Hogan. T.S. Hogan. I'm staying down at the Hotel Saratoga."
"Eh? What can we do for you?"
"Well, I was just wondering if you knew where I might be able to buy a good flock of sheep."
"Sheep, huh? Don't reckon you'll find nobody willing to talk sheep selling today, Mr. Hogan."
Just a minute. How long you been in town, Mr. Hogan?"
"Oh, about 3 weeks. Why?"
"Have you heard what happened here last night?"
Well, yes, of course. I heard that ex-governor Sternenberg..."
"Yeah. You'll excuse me for saying this, but it appears to me like you're taking this murder mighty cool-like."
"Cool? Well, after all, I came to Caldwell to..."
"Suppose we take a walk down to the city hall and talk a little more about why you come to Caldwell."
Identified as Harry Orchard, former officer in a miner's organization, the suspect was charged with first-degree murder. There flocked to Idaho scores of detectives determined upon solving the crime. One was quiet, intelligent, professorial 67-year-old James McParland, who for more than a week visited Orchard in his cell for hours at a time. One day in the front office of the jail...
"Well, Mr. McParland, anything new?"
"Yes, Sheriff, I believe there is. Harry Orchard is your man."
"Well, how'd you find that out?"
"I have just now procured a full confession in detail from Orchard that he not only set the bomb which killed Sternenberg, but that he is the murderer of 18 people in the past 10 years."
Well, why? What's it all about? Why did he kill Sternenberg?"
"Harry Orchard has just informed me that he is in the pay of three members of a mining association, William D. Haywood, Charles H. Moyer, and George A. Pettibone. And it was by their instruction that he killed ex-governor Sternenberg."
The three new figures in the case were brought to trial. Chief defense counsel was Clarence Darrow, while the prosecution was guided by the then little-known U.S. Senator-elect, William E. Borah.
Finally, on the morning of July 28, guided by instructions from the presiding judge...
"Gentlemen of the jury, under the statutes of this state, a person cannot be convicted of a crime upon the testimony of an accomplice, unless such accomplice is corroborated by other evidence."
And realizing the only star witness for the state had been Harry Orchard, the jury of 12 men brought in the verdict...
"Not guilty."
And the historic Haywood trial was at an end.
...1907. That was a year...
that in the drab, leaden dawn of the morning of October 21... a passerby noticed a cluster of people standing in front of the four massive columns of the Knickerbocker Trust Company of New York. Brows clouded with anxiety...
Good morning.
Is it?
What's the matter? What are all you people standing here for?
Waiting for 9 o'clock.
9 o'clock? Why, that's when the bank opens.
Yeah, we're waiting to get our money out, if we can.
Why, what do you mean? I've got money in there, too. What do you mean?
You'd better get in line then, mister. All the banks in town are going to have a tough time today.
And the panic of 1907 had begun. The financial phenomenon which in a few days transformed the United States into a chaotic imbroglio of seething depositors, all struggling in the vain attempt to withdraw their funds from banks. At the height of the panic, a group of financial moguls arranged for the importation of $100 million in gold to be deposited with banks of the U.S. In a few weeks, the spectacle of the 1907 panic was on its decline.
1907. That was the year
that America was whistling, singing, humming, dancing to Franz Lehár's perennial Merry Widow Waltz.
Now or never, and forever, I love you. Let me hold you till I've told you I love you. I believe in magic.
That was The Year, Montuned to Yesterday, a syndicated recording from 1935. And to wrap up this hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday, a moment from the Behind the Mic series, which told stories of radio behind the scenes during its golden era. This excerpt from October 20th, 1940, with Goodwill Hour host John J. Anthony.
Each week, puzzled, sometimes frightened, sometimes despairing people seek the advice of social expert John J. Anthony on his radio Goodwill Hour, hoping that he will point out a solution of their problems. You have heard him advise them. But here are stories of what happens to these people after they have left Mr. Anthony's program. Stories the radio public never hears. Tonight, for the first time, Behind the Mic brings you the story of the result of Mr. Anthony's advice in what he calls his most astounding case. Mr. John J. Anthony. Mr. Anthony, will you please tell us about that story?
Yes, Mr. McNamee. That case gave me the most terrific shock I've ever had during my career in radio. On one week's program, I asked one man to state his problem, and to my shock and amazement, he began like this. I said to him, "What is your business?" And he said, Mr. Anthony,
my business is killing.
What do you mean?
I'm a gunner in the Navy, and I'm going to kill a man.
Do you realize what you're saying?
Yes, I do, but it's the only way out. You see, I'm in love with a woman, and she's in love with me. But she's married, and her husband won't give her a divorce. He won't divorce her, well, out of sheer cussedness. He doesn't love her, but he doesn't want me to marry her. I've decided that there's only one thing to do, and that's to put him out of the way. That's the only way she'll get her freedom. So I'm going to kill him.
You must have been shocked when you heard that. What did you do then, Mr. Anthony?
Naturally, I pointed out to him that he certainly wasn't going to be able to marry this woman if he killed her husband. He'd be arrested and executed, and that would be the end of it. In the meantime, I wrote a note to the announcer and handed it to him. In the note, I told the announcer to have this man's overcoat, which he had hung outside the studio, searched. Inside the man's coat was found a large, heavy jack handle, a perfect instrument with which to club someone. So I knew he was serious in his intention. I asked him to wait for me after the show, and he did. When the program was over, I told him that I could very easily have him committed to Bellevue Hospital for psychiatric examination to determine his sanity, but I was more anxious to straighten him out. I made him promise that he would do nothing that evening, but would come to see me the following day at my office. He promised.
Did you feel his promise was worth anything?
Oh, yes, in this case. After all, he had been contemplating killing this man for some time, and he'd come to me for help, and he still wanted it. So he wasn't going to do anything until at least after he had seen me again.
Well, why did you have him come to your office?
Well, because I wanted to get in touch with a well-known psychiatrist, have him see the sailor, and try to straighten him out, which was exactly what he did in a series of interviews.
And how did it all end? Did the man divorce his wife, and did the sailor marry her?
Oh, no, Graham. It might have happened that way in a story, but not in real life. That was different. You see, the psychiatrist confirmed what I had suspected all along. The sailor wasn't really in love with this woman. It was a case of frustration. He probably wanted to marry her at one time, but since he wasn't and since she was married, that was quite impossible. But the fact that he couldn't made him all the more determined that he would, even if he had to kill her husband to do it. The finish of the story, Graham, is that the husband, when he discovered that the sailor didn't want to marry his wife, gave her a divorce. I got her a job. The sailor didn't marry her, but he didn't kill the husband either. And there you are.
And thank you, John J. Anthony, for an unusual Behind the Mic story.
An excerpt of Behind the Mic on Tuned to Yesterday from October 20th, 1940 on the NBC Blue Network. Advice giver John J. Anthony hosted his call-in program, turning out to be one of the pioneers of that format from 1937 through 1953. And that wraps up this hour of True History on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for tuning in.